All right, let's turn to Genesis 9, as I mentioned. A couple weeks ago, we were looking at Genesis 9. We got started just kind of there at the beginning of the chapter. As you know, we've come through the flood at this point. Noah and his family have exited off the ark. As we mentioned in our last study, the first thing Noah does is he builds that altar and offers sacrifice to God. As you begin chapter 9, God makes a promise, doesn't he? Before that, let's back up. We mentioned God gives a warning first and then a promise. What's his warning? Shedding blood, right? Murdering. That comes, you know, not too long ago, we were looking at Cain and Abel and how Cain had murdered his brother. And then after that, we noticed how the world just became more and more violent. And we're reminded here in Genesis 9, 1 and following, that God again warns against the shedding of blood. There's a couple echoes in this text I think are interesting. If you look at verse 1, you have a familiar echo of Genesis 1, chapter 1. He said, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. If you go back to Genesis 1 and verse 27, that's actually verse 28, it's almost the same language there in chapter 1. God is again commanding man to be fruitful and to multiply and to fill the earth. Now, of course, when we get to Genesis 11, that's going to be an issue for man. He's going to not do exactly what God has wanted him to do. He also allows, at this time, man to take his food, animals. Now, up until this point, man's been vegetarian. That seems what the text says to me. I don't notice anywhere. If you go back to Genesis 1, as he blesses man, he then goes on to say that God's given him the herbs to eat as food, and he does the same for animals. And so when we get to chapter 9, that all changes. And there's an interesting consequence of that. What's the consequence of God now allowing man to eat animals? What? Well, he says, he warns them, don't consume the blood. But what's that? Yeah, now the big implication of this, we could probably imagine, but we're getting a little bit off into opinion. But he does mention that at this point, now there's going to be a fear in animals of man, because of man now being able to partake of animals. That's interesting, isn't it? What does the sin of violence bring into the world? Not only are you bringing violence into the world and death, but it also leads to what? Fear and dread. He does give the prohibition against eating blood. Now, there's also something else we ought to keep in mind. All of these things that he's talking about predate what law? Law of Moses. These are all things that predate the law of Moses. Now, these things are incorporated into the law of Moses, but realize that like marriage and some of his other things, these things were not they didn't originate with the law of Moses. They were there from very early on. And so he then gives the prohibition against shedding blood. And he goes on in verse 6 to say, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Which in the text, what is God allowing for? Actually commanding. This is actually a command, by the way. What is he commanding?
The death penalty.
The death penalty, right? I don't know if you can say it much clearer. So death penalty judgments, biblically speaking, from the book of Genesis, are loud, right? God says to Noah and to his descendants, you are to punish those who murder, those who commit that kind of violence. And then again, you notice, he reiterates in verse 7, verse 1. He says in verse 7, be fruitful, multiply, increase greatly on the earth, and multiply in it. So you get in verse 1 and verse 7, what mandate? Populate the earth. You need to go and fill it. Now, in this moment, that may seem like a very, very big task. How many human beings do you have in existence in this moment?
Eight.
That's it. But with these eight, God is going to go once again repopulate the earth. We have, as far as I know, we can do some statistics and things about an estimate how many people were alive before the flood, but we don't know exactly what that would have been. What was the number of people before the flood? But you have went from a much larger number to eight. And so through these eight individuals, the earth will be once again repopulated. And we'll talk more about that as we move forward. All right, any questions about that part? All right, let's turn our attention now to the heritage of Noah. Let's see. I don't want to forget this. So if you go down to verses 8 and following, God establishes another covenant with man and with the world. What is that? This is an easy one. What?
He will never again destroy the earth with a flood.
Yeah, so there will never be a worldwide flood as there was in Noah's day. God appoints the rainbow as a sign of the covenant he's made with mankind and the world, that he will never allow that to happen again. So there'll only be that one. But will God allow the world to last forever? Now, what does 2 Peter chapter 3 tell us? 2 Peter 3 and verse 10, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which what? What?
No man
knows. It'll come like a thief, but then in which the heavens will be dissolved, being burned up. All right, and so the second destruction that will come upon the world is pictured as what?
Fire.
And so the world will be destroyed at that time with fire. But he will not do it again with water. It's also interesting, just as a side note, the kind of turn there, water used in Genesis 6 through 9 as punishment and as destruction. And then when you get to the New Testament, water then becomes what?
Salvation.
Kind of interesting. If you go to Peter also writing about Noah, he says the light figure wherein eight souls were saved by water. Like the antitype or in like fashion, baptism does now what? Save us. And so so God takes that which destroyed, now it's what brings salvation. All right. Okay. Any questions about that? I'm covering some of this kind of quicker because we've already mentioned it a little bit. All right, let's go down to verse 18. I was thinking about this earlier. Some of this, I was trying to make it, try to think how to make this really interesting. Some of this won't be very, like, super, like, exciting stuff, but it's important. So when we get into the genealogies, I'll try to cover that as well as we can and try to bring out some things maybe we need to think about But I'll admit some of this is a little tougher in presenting it, just presenting the information. But if y'all will talk with me, it'll help. Yes, sir.
I'll talk. Is 9:3 the verse that you're looking at about not eating meat before?
So I'm going back to Genesis 1, right, where he says, I give you the herb, the herbs for food, right? To you it shall be for food. And he's talking about vegetation. There is no allowance given. You would have to think it would be implied to think meat was allowed prior to that. You see what I'm saying? Because it is not explicit.
So what do you think Abel did with his flocks?
Well, there's other things we get out of that, right?
Clothes.
Huh?
Clothes,
milk, right? Those kinds of things.
Animal products.
Yeah, I would assume you could eat animal products, the things they produce, but actually eating animals, again, if they did it, it's something not stated explicitly. There's no explicit allowance for it in Scripture. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It sacrificed them, and it was the meat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I struggle to find, how do they know what the best ones were if they don't know what the best, you know, animals tasted like?
But maybe it has nothing to do with taste. Maybe it's an evaluation of the way they look.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be, right? I mean, it's too late.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going on what I can know definitively from Scripture. And so I don't want to speak too definite on it. It seems to me they were vegetarian. Maybe that's the best way to say it. Seems to me they were vegetarian prior to that. But after this point, they definitely are not. So after 9, they're definitely not because God allows it. I guess you could make an individual choice that you don't want to. Yes, ma'am.
On the chart, what is AM for
years?
I think it's ages of one. It's from the Mace. I think it's the Masoretic text. So that's a whole big discussion.
I was curious because it says is, you know, 0 AM, so it's some kind of, you know, like time. I just was wondering what AM stood for.
Adam to Moses. That's what it means. Adam to Moses. Because you start at A at the top, Moses at the bottom. Sorry, I hadn't really thought that through yet. But yeah, A.M., Adam to Moses. It's the time the chart covers A, Adam, to M, Moses. That's the years it covers. No, I think it's really honestly what it means. I'm not joking about that.
Oh, no.
That's for real what it means. Yeah. All right. So let's go back to Genesis 9. Anything else from that text? Okay. So let's go. All right, let's see. Let's go down to verse 18. All right, so we get an interesting narrative laid out here. And so let's just read it and then we'll talk about it. So verse 18, then the sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. In other words, we all came from those three men. The earth was populated from those three. Now, that is not a birth order, is it? How do we know that? Ham is actually the youngest, not not Japheth. It is interesting. He wants us to understand something about Ham, doesn't he? He is the father of Canaan. Now, how do we know Canaan? The land of Canaan here, right? So his descendants, we'll see this in a minute, but his descendants settled in this area. Now that's important biblically. Why? Because that's the promised land. When we get later into the Exodus out of Egypt, where are they traveling to? Canaan. We sing that song, "To Canaan's Land, I'm on my way," right? Just keep that in mind. We'll get more into that in just a minute. So let's read it. So you have the three sons. Then verse 20. Noah became a man of the soil, or some translations have tiller of the ground. Now, the Greek, I'm sorry, not the Greek, the Hebrew implies that he is the first, right? The first tiller of the ground in a vineyard. I know Cain was also a farmer, but this seems to imply he was the first one to plant a vineyard. Okay. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, again, he's emphasizing that, isn't he? Saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, meaning facing away from their father, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done. Okay, before I get into the curse and the blessing, so you've got Noah. Again, the text implies he's the first to work a vineyard. I don't want to try to pull more than this out of the text, but we know what happens to fermenting wine, fermenting juice, right? Grape juice. Eventually, through a process of those molecules, that those juices turn into what? Alcohol, right? Those alcohol molecules begin to form, and what was once a drink that would not intoxicate you now becomes an intoxicating drink. Now, whether or not Noah just simply didn't know, or he's simply disobeying God's command against being drunken, of course, at this point, God hasn't given us an explicit command in the text. Now, whether he told Noah explicitly, I don't know, or his fathers, but he becomes drunk. Either way, it's interesting. The scripture nowhere condemns Noah for this. Now, we know drunkenness is condemned vehemently later, but he becomes drunken. And what does he do? He's laying around naked in his tent. Again, another interesting parallel. When you go back to Genesis chapter 3, what was the thing that Adam and Eve did immediately upon knowledge of once they received the fruit, the knowledge from that tree, what was the first thing they did? Tried to cover up. Now, you remember even God later made them, he had to make them some clothes because they weren't doing, I don't think they were doing a good enough job. So, nakedness is one of those naturally sinful practices. And whether I'm naked, well, I don't want to picture that, whether someone is naked in public or if I'm viewing someone naked, that is a sinful thing to do. And it goes against nature. There is a natural thing where we should be covered up. We should not show our nakedness. But I think in another way, this nakedness, the story, symbolizes something. That the nakedness symbolizes something else.
Shame
and sin, right? In essence, Noah had shown forth his shame, his sin, and his son, instead of covering up or trying to hide his father's nakedness, just simply goes out and tells his brothers. What's the difference between the way Ham responded as opposed, I meant Ham. What's the difference between the way Ham reacted as opposed to Shem and Japheth? What made theirs correct and his incorrect?
Because they didn't look upon it.
They didn't gaze upon it.
And they covered him up.
They covered him up.
It almost like condoning. Like they didn't condone it. They took care of him and made him different. They dressed him. They covered him up. Whereas the other guys, the other brothers, not like he didn't. I mean, he was maybe laughing at it, but he looked at it, but he just kind of let it go.
Yeah, he didn't try to do anything to stop it.
He spread the knowledge of it as well.
Yeah, and he spread the knowledge of it. That's a great thing. Gossip very early on in the text. And we know that Ham's behavior is condemned when we see the reaction of Noah. So you go back to verse 25. Noah said, cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. Now, you see this with the patriarchal fathers quite often, and normally it comes in the blessing at the end of their life. But they'll bless their children or maybe even their grandchildren. You see it with Israel blessing his children, his grandchildren. You see it with Isaac and others as well. They give these blessings. And what's interesting is often in those blessings, you also find prophecy. You see this in the blessings that Isaac gives to Esau and to Jacob, right? I said Isaac, right? Isaac does that with his two sons. And it becomes prophetic in nature. It's not just a blessing on that particular child or a grown man, however it may be. But it also has a much longer lasting kind of effect to it. Well, here, What's the curse that's laid on Canaan? Okay. Just name one of them. He'll be a servant. Did you say, I thought you said several. No, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. He said servant. That's correct, right? What does that imply, that concept of servant? Yes, that's it. So it's the idea of rule, right? That someone else will be ruler over you. It's a power dynamic that's being laid out. It's not just that he's going to do something good for his brother. It has a deeper implication to it. Now, casting forward, we think about the land of Canaan. That's what played out, right? When the children of Israel came into the land, finally after the 40 years of wandering, what happened? What happened?
They
conquered the land, right? They took it by force away from who? The descendants of Ham. Those are his children that they are taking it from. And so he lays out the curse on Canaan, but he also provides a blessing. Who is he blessing in this? Shem and Japheth, right? Now, who, when we look at the descendants of Shem, who are we talking about? Well, that becomes a major focus of the Old Testament, because who later came from the lineage of Shem? Abraham, right? Abraham came through the lineage of Shem. Later on, that would lead to who? Well, the children of Israel, who would eventually come through Shem's lineage. And that, so that really does play out.
Brian, do we know where they are now? Where on the map?
So I'm going to talk about that when we get there. But in chapter 10, we know a little bit. I don't want to go too far with it, but there are, when you go through that list in chapter 10, he notes some things specifically. Let me just hold that for 1 second. Well, I want to come back to that. So that's a really good question. So let's just end this chapter real quick. So verse 28, after the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. So Noah, in the lifespan, amongst the lifespans of history, he lived a long time. I mean, there are only a few that outlived him. You might think about Methuselah, maybe a couple others that lived a little bit longer than him. But that's a pretty significant amount of time. However, when we look at our chart, the one I passed out, what do you notice immediately after Noah? There is a stark decrease in ages. So this goes through Shem's lineage, not through the other sons. But you notice Shem, so Noah lives 950, but Shem, what? 600. That's 300 years less. That's a third less than Noah. That's significant. And then you get to Arphaxad, you know, 438, kind of close to the same, not too far. But then when you get to Peleg, you notice another huge decrease. Peleg only lives 239 years. What's interesting, if you look at Shem outlived his son Arphaxad. He outlived Shelah. He almost lived as long as Eber. But then all those underneath, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, Tahar, and then finally at Abraham outlives him by a little bit. But this is also fascinating. Shem lives through a long time into the life of Abram. Abram. And then, of course, you got Isaac, on down to Moses, and you can see that slower descent at that point. But even when you get to Moses, how far are you off from the death of Shem? About 500 years. So it's not this big, vast amount of time in that. And why is that? Well, it's because their ages began to decrease so quickly. Now, why is that? Well, I'm not a scientist to tell you one way or another about that, but but the world has changed, hasn't it? The environment's changed. The quality of life has changed. The quality of your food has changed. So a lot of things have led to this decrease. Probably hard to pinpoint one reason why, but you do see the decrease, and I think that's interesting to look at. So next week, we'll get into chapter 10. Sorry I didn't get there, Vance, this week. But when you do go, we won't spend as much time on chapter 10, but he does give us some, in this listing of genealogies, he gives us some names are important, like Egypt, some names like Haran and Ur, right, that are significant as we move forward. Any other questions before we close out? Go ahead.
So do you think Noah had any more daughters?
I have no idea, to be honest.
It says the earth was
Mm-hmm.
But at the beginning, he blesses Noah and his sons so that it tells them to go to wives.
Yeah. I don't.
Wives, so they could have boys and girls.
Yeah, and well, we know later on, I mean, Abraham marries his sister. So that continued for a while, this inner family marriages. Mm-hmm. And even Isaac, Rebecca was what, his, was it his cousin? They're related, they're not too far off. Yeah.
But they could have also had children closer than they were having before the flood.
You mean sooner, like they were started having children earlier? They would have had to, right?
Genealogy, you're talking about hundreds of years. They could have had other children that weren't mentioned in the genealogy.
And we know the Bible does not give us, it's not by no means exhaustive. I think it's trying to give us more of a timeline than it is an exhaustive genealogy. And so the Bible really concentrates, from my understanding, more on significant to God's plan people. So what God's trying to accomplish. Not the Bible is not interested in detail for the sake of detail. Now we are. I love details. They interest me, but God's I believe God is driven more by accomplishing his end goal. Yes, ma'am, then we'll come to Carol.
Real quick, I did get an answer on what AM stands for. It stands for Anno Mundi, which is Latin, so it is one of the Latin terms. It means year after creation. It's a calendar-based era system based on the biblical events, so it's just saying that's why zero, because that's what they consider the
Oh, okay, so that's the beginning of creation. Okay.
It's just another Latin time.
Okay. Miss Carol.
Vegetarians would say the reason lifespan was shorter was because people started eating meat.
They might, yeah, but their vegetables were better quality too during that time. I love meat, so I enjoy that part. Okay, thank you all. We'll dismiss from class and we'll let the young men.